Natural gas drilling has claimed important habitat for wildlife, but scientists are working on small steps to get it back.
This is only a 13 by 13 foot square, but to a bumblebee, this is a fantastic ecosystem right here.
I'm Carol Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, regrowing forests and fields after fracking. And there's no one way to be a climate activist.
There are numerous evangelicals who are really working hard within their communities to raise awareness about the climate crisis.
Plus, grocery stores are one place to find food, and that apple tree along the sidewalk on your route to work is another.
I think it's just a good reminder that even though we rely on products, we can feed ourselves.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Over the next century, new research shows the warming climate will dramatically alter ecosystems. For example, turning forests into grasslands or grasslands into deserts. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports the changes are expected to upend many of the natural environments humans rely on.
To figure out how future warming will affect ecosystems, a team of 42 scientists spent 5 years peering into the distant past. In a new study published in the journal Science, they analyzed ancient fossilized pollen and plant data across the globe and found that without major reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, many of the planet's ecosystems will look very different in the next 100 to 150 years. Sarah Ivory, an assistant professor with Penn State's Department of Geosciences, is one of the co-authors, and she focuses on Africa.
For example, in a lot of parts of Africa, there are a lot of very rural populations that live very closely on the landscape that depend on ecosystems for clean water, for soil retention and soil formation.
The records they analyzed showed a gradual change over thousands of years. So Ivory says the new study is a conservative estimate of how much things might be disrupted in the coming century. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
The stark findings of climate scientists and the mounting evidence that climate change is already impacting us has people marching in the streets, from labor unions to religious groups. This coalition is calling for environmental justice and a just transition to renewable energy that protects workers and frontline communities. We talked to one of their organizers in advance of the People's Climate Movement March. Fletcher Harper is an Episcopal priest and executive director of an organization called Green Faith. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant spoke with Harper for our podcast, Trump on Earth.
Can you start by telling us, what is Green Faith?
We're an interfaith environmental organization. We educate and inspire and mobilize people from a diverse range of religious and spiritual backgrounds around the world to take action for the earth. So we do campaigning work, we educate and train leaders, we advocate, we mobilize, and that's why we're going to be in the streets this Saturday with lots of other colleagues.
So why do you think climate change has become a top priority for you and for some other religious leaders?
There's this deep, deep shared understanding that the earth is a gift and that it's our responsibility to take care of that gift, and that things have gotten way, way out of balance and that we have to wake up and take action, and that we need our leaders to take action. That's the basic shared narrative of the world's religious and spiritual communities around climate and environmental issues. And I think what's driving this growth in interest in and focus on climate change is the fact that it's clearer and clearer that we're falling incredibly dangerously far behind where we need to be. We need our leaders to create policies that are going to get us the sustainable future that we need in a way that creates good jobs, that rebuild the middle class, that lift people out of poverty, and that create cleaner air and safer communities for those neighborhoods and communities that are getting hit hardest by the climate crisis, though they've done the least to create it.
We know that the health concerns in our vulnerable communities. We know our frontline communities are dying. So are you saying that you don't care about our frontline community? Are you saying that you don't care about people of color as we continue to die?
Yeah, some are calling the events this weekend the People's Climate March Part 3. So what started as a march has what been upgraded to maybe a movement. Can you tell us more about the People's Climate Movement and the demonstrations that are being planned? Like, where will you be marching and what's going to be happening?
The People's Climate Movement, or PCM, we got started in 2014 in New York. Ban Ki-moon, who was the Secretary General at the time, called for a global climate change summit of world leaders.
In cities around the world, hundreds of thousands of people called for action. They demanded that leaders lead. That is why we are here today. We are not here to talk. We are here to make history.
A group of activists realized that without serious street heat, we weren't going to see leaders do what they needed to do. And so a coalition of groups, including Green Faith, came together. And again, it was, you know, environmental, labor, social, racial, environmental justice, student. We organized a march that ended up being an unbelievable success. We had more than 400,000 people.
As we just reported, hundreds of thousands of people marched today in New York.
The event is billed as the People's Climate March. This has turned into a massive protest. You're on the streets with the marchers. What are you seeing and hearing?
Well, it's very big. It is orderly, at least from where I can tell, and it is loud.
Last year in 2017, we organized the People's Climate March in D.C. as a way of saying that regardless of what's coming from the White House, we need leaders that are going to lead on climate, not lag, and not throw a wrecking ball into the works of the work that's been done so far.
Take a deep breath of air. You are fighting for that.
You know, it is a movement. It's messy, as movements are, but what the public doesn't see is the dozens and dozens and hundreds of people and these leaders and from different constituencies and different perspectives are getting to know each other. It's the invisible work that PCM is doing in a lot of places, and it's really irreplaceable.
After President Trump announced that the U.S. was going to pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement, many religious leaders stepped up, responded swiftly. But evangelicals in the U.S. who represent a large voting bloc and helped elect President Trump were largely silent. Why do you think evangelicals in particular are so skeptical of climate change?
The challenge is that we live in this hyper-polarized period of time where tribalism makes it more and more difficult for evangelicals, a majority of whom fall into the more Republican or conservative end of the cultural spectrum, to cross that line and to engage with climate seriously, because climate change gets painted with the big broad stroke brush that other culture war issues get painted with. That said, I think that there's no question, and it's been proven, that there are ways to frame the conversation about climate change in a way that works for evangelicals, that focuses it on an issue of protecting life out of respect to God, the creator of life, and God, the creator of the planet, that it is our stewardship responsibility to be keepers of the dominion that God has given us. So it's a little bit like asking, you know, why are there so few Republicans in Congress who are stepping up on climate change? It's because everybody's afraid of the current sort of hyper-partisan climate and the bully pulpit that, unfortunately, this administration has chosen to deploy in vicious ways to sort of shift dialogue.
So there are a variety of numbers out there, like those from the Environmental Voter Project, showing that only 50% of environmentalists voted in the 2016 presidential election, compared with 69% among all registered voters. So do you see climate change and the environment becoming major voting issues? Meaning, do you think we'll see more environmental voters, people who care about these issues, stepping to the voting booth in the midterm elections and leading into 2020?
We'll see more, for the very simple reason that the impacts are becoming more and more real. When you've got the state of California on fire for 6 months out of the year, when you've got levels of drought that are hitting farmers more and more, when you see these kinds of impacts, it becomes more and more impossible to ignore them. You see storms at massive scales, heat waves that are affecting huge parts of the country. As the impacts become clearer, the connection with voting and the prominence of the issue, as is always the case, will rise. The challenge with climate change is that we've got to get there faster than that. And that's, again, part of why the mobilization this Saturday is so important. It's a way of trying, in a peaceful, creative, multi-sector way, lifting up an incredible and beautiful diversity of voices to say, you know, it's here and now. It's not 10 years from now. It's not 5 years from now. And we need to make these moves now. And because we're not getting leadership at the federal level, we need that leadership at the local and regional level, because that's where real change can happen at scale. That's the message.
Fletcher Harper is an Episcopal priest and executive director of Green Faith. The Allegheny Friends' Julie Grant spoke with Harper for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more about the People's Climate Movement at trumponearth.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. If you think unearthing hundreds of years of plant samples tucked into dusty museum cabinets sounds boring, think again. What if extinct species could be brought back to life?
It's more like a Jurassic Park dream. But DNA is DNA, who knows? Before 1952, we wouldn't have known what DNA was, right? And much less that you could get it out of museum specimens.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, how digitizing historical plant information is bringing exciting new possibilities into the light. Stay tuned. Nearly 1,800 acres of state-owned forest in Pennsylvania have been cleared for natural gas drilling over the past decade. That's wiped out habitat for many native species. For our Wild PA series, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier checked in with researchers who are trying to bring some of it back.
Kelly Sitch is an ecologist with the Pennsylvania Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. And right now, he's walking in a clearing deep in the Tyodotten State Forest in north-central Pennsylvania. We're surrounded by wildflowers and tall grasses in what is essentially an outdoor laboratory.
Here's a mix that was all native grasses and wildflowers. As you can see right now, this appears to be solid wild bergamot.
Sitch and a group of scientists have divvied up this clearing into dozens of small plots, each planted with different species. The one we're standing next to was planted with wild bergamot. It's a native species with light purple flowers that look like pom-poms. Butterflies and bees hover over these chest-high flowers on this warm summer morning.
This is only a 13 by 13 foot square, but to a bumblebee, this is a fantastic ecosystem right here. So it wouldn't take a very large portion of a well pad edge to provide a lot of ecosystem benefits.
DCNR has leased over 100,000 acres of state forest to the gas industry for fracking in the Marcellus Shale. Here in the Tyodotten, the industry has cut down around 1,000 acres of forest to make way for well pads, pipelines, and compressor stations. Sitch says most of this land won't be grown back as forests, at least not for decades.
But there's a lot of areas around the edge of the well pad that have been cleared, or perhaps areas that were used to store water trucks or fracking equipment that's no longer necessary when it's just in production.
And it's these areas, around the edges of gas development, that Sitch and his colleagues like Patrick Drohan want to resuscitate. Drohan, a soil scientist at Penn State, says the problem isn't just that the forest has been cut down. To build a well pad, companies use heavy equipment to compact the ground underneath.
Most of the time, what's done for these types of operations is they compact to what's called no movement. And that standard is similar when you're building a parking lot. It's similar to when you're building a shale gas pad.
And that's not good for plants to grow in. Compacted soil has fewer pores to store water or gases that a plant needs to survive.
So in this case, what we're trying to do is alleviate deep compaction. And to do that, you need to use big equipment to rip the soil.
The team brought in a bulldozer with a special attachment on it to cut into the compacted soil. Basically, they tilled the ground to varying depths to see which depth worked best. One row at the far end of the plot has not been loosened at all. Not surprisingly, it's doing worse than the other rows.
That far row is much less drought tolerant than the other three rows. And we're seeing a lot more non-native invasive species that can still tolerate that very dry soil.
The goal, Sitch says, is to give gas companies step-by-step instructions for repairing and replanting the borders of their well pads, pipelines, and other construction areas. He doesn't think cost should be a problem for most companies.
You're really getting down to almost less than $2,000 an acre, which may be a lot of money to you and I, but when you're talking about multi-million dollar operations over many sites, it's not really very much of a money commitment.
For now, the agency isn't proposing to make any of these methods mandatory. And so far, Sitch says, gas companies have been receptive to the group's ideas. The Tyodotten State Forest is 150,000 acres. Sitch says even if they can only restore a few hundred of these, that would be worth it.
If we're creating habitat for insects, for songbirds, butterflies and moths, native plants, that's a great deal of real estate.
Bringing back some of the forest is better than none at all. Yeah. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Yeah, it's a swallowtail, a native butterfly.
That story is part of our ongoing series, Wild PA. All of the stories and interviews are at AlleghenyFront.org, including a conversation I had with a researcher about how natural gas pipelines are affecting wildlife. That's at AlleghenyFront.org/WildPA. There's free food all around us, if you know where to look. And Sarah Burr does.
I am a chef and a writer and a plant nerd.
Burr is also the author of a new book, The Fruit Forager's Companion, ferments, desserts, main dishes, and more from your neighborhood and beyond. It's part cookbook and part guide. Burr joined me at the edge of a park in Pittsburgh recently to show me how it's done. And it only took her a few minutes to find something tasty.
Oh my gosh, this is it. This is a spice bush shrub. It has these little berries. They started as green. This one is gorgeous and bright red. It's about the size of my fingertip. It's oblong. And if you crush it, it has a really strong piney scent.
Oh yeah.
I like to dehydrate them and use them as a spice. I think it goes really well with rich and fatty meats because it cuts through. It's got that resinous rosemary type flavor. You can also use the leaves to make a tea. I like fruit, so I just stick to the berries. But this year has been bonkers with these. When I come to a bush, I usually, if it has a decent amount of berries, I usually gather about a third of the ripe ones because I don't want to take them all away. They're beautiful, and if somebody else comes through, I want them to enjoy those berries, even if they're not, even if they don't know what they are. Also, the wildlife definitely enjoys these berries. If you love birds, you can plant spice bush in your yard and they will come and enjoy the berries.
This is probably a bush I have passed by like so many times and never even realized what it was.
Yes, and that's the wonderful thing when you first start recognizing different plants, you experience everything around you on a whole new level. So if you see the same things every single day and you want something new in your life, instead of changing where you are, you can change how you perceive things. And there's always something new to learn, even if you've been at it for years and years and years.
Why fruit?
Fruit is really attractive to me because it's colorful. If not on the outside, on the inside. I like the way fruit tastes. It's easier to identify because it's just there. Whereas with greens, which many people forage for, you need to be a little bit more on your game. But the fruit is just bong. It's like an advertisement, right? It wants to be noticed. It wants you to notice it. And you can use it in so many different ways. It's not always desserty. So what we think of as fruit is a specific part of the plant. It's what is around the seed. It's not something that is sweet you make into pies, necessarily. As a chef, I appreciate that. It's a way for, it's a prompt for me to think about ingredients differently.
I love a lot of the history that you put into your book and, you know, the research that you've done and some of the words around foraging. For example, what is scrumping?
Scrumping is, first of all, is just a very fun word. And I hope it doesn't end up getting overused the way bespoke has. That's a great word, and I think people use it way more than they should. They've taken all the fun out of that word. So I want people to use the word scrumping and maybe to scrump a little bit, but don't use it don't ruin the word for all of us. Scrumping is petty theft of fruit. And it originated in England specific to apples, scrumping apples. So if you're in an orchard and you just nab a few apples as a snack, it's like the most innocent of theft. And I definitely scrump. I will admit it. It's kind of fun to do something wrong. So maybe I'll scrump a little bit and then I'll ask if there's a tree. It doesn't have to be apples, but if somebody has fruit in their yard, I will ask them for permission to collect it. But I may have tasted a sample before I do so. So that is scrumping.
What are some of the other things people can forage now and in other seasons in this region? Like some of your favorites?
I really love black cherries, and I'm not talking about the black cherries you get at the grocery store. I will eat those too. There is a native cherry tree called black cherry, and I believe the scientific name is Prunus serotina. You see these trees in forests, not so much in yards, and they can get really big, but the cherries are just now ending because they're starting to get overripe and fall. But they are about the size of a pea to the size of a really big pea. They're not very big, and they're about 50% pit, so you don't get a lot of flesh from them. They are very, very dark when they're ripe, and they dangle in these little clusters from the tree. They just fall from the tree when they're ripe, so if you shake a tree with a tarp underneath, they'll fall down on the tarp, and you can gather them that way. But I see them a lot when I hike in cemeteries, and when you get a good one, they're really good, and you just spit out the pit. When you get one that's not good, you spit the whole thing out. But I think of them as a wonderful little hiking snack. And once again, they're great to use. You would never want to make them into a pie. It would take years. But you can use them in infusion. So I have a cherry bounce recipe, which is brandy and sugar and cherries. And I've done that with the black cherries. I have a cherry balsamic vinegar recipe where you just get cheap balsamic and steep the cherries, including the pits in there, and then eventually strain those out. So there are lots of infusions you can make with cherries like that where you get all that great flavor, because I feel like it's cherries squared. That's how intense it is. And they do take a little while to harvest. So you can do these things where that flavor intensity is maximized and your labor is minimized.
You know, I read in the book where you say that foraging is flipping the bird to industrialized food. What do you mean by that?
I think it doesn't even occur to many of us, and it didn't to me, that food isn't something that's completely removed from us. Having worked in the food service industry, it's always fascinating to me to have been on the back end and think about how differently somebody perceives something once it's in a package. That means it's safe and it's okay, but you can go out and get your own food and figure things out on your own, and I think that makes you a little bit bolder about being informed and making your own choices about the food that you buy. I think it really empowers you to make decisions about your own health and what you're offering to other people that you might be cooking for. So I think it's just a good reminder that even though we rely on products, we can feed ourselves. And even if that's just like a tiny handful of berries that you got when you were out on a jog, it doesn't matter. It's just nice to have those reminders.
There's more from my conversation with chef and author Sarah Burr about her book, The Fruit Forager's Companion, plus a recipe for habanero crab apple jelly. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. How do we know so much about which plants are good to eat and their history? Well, for centuries, scientists and amateur botanists scoured the country to document and preserve plant species. Their collections were highly prized, like fine art. Now there's a new effort to digitize all this information, and it could be a boon for researchers. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
On the fifth floor of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, in a cool, windowless room that smells a little pungent, tall metal cabinets store some of the most famous dead plants in the world.
So this is called Grundelia squarosa.
Rick McCourt is the botany curator here, and he reads the notes scribbled around this dried and pressed, pretty yellow flower.
And so it says prairies in the camp, near the old Maha village, that's a Native American village, September 17th, 1804.
Members of the Lewis and Clark expedition collected this medicinal flower. This herbarium, like a library for plants, is the oldest in North America. McCourt says it has more than a million dried plants collected by explorers, botanists, and citizen scientists over the past 400 years.
I almost think of it like any collector, like, you know, baseball trading cards. I mean, it was a competitive game to see if you could describe a lot of new species, find a lot of new species, make them valuable to the people you're either working for or your own reputation scientifically. And there were different levels of vanity associated with it, I would say.
These collections are difficult to access. But now, there's a massive effort to photograph and make available online hundreds of thousands of plants housed in about a dozen institutions on the East Coast. It's called the Mid-Atlantic Megalopolis Project. McCourt says hundreds of years of plant data could answer questions about conservation, climate change, and development.
But like, how has the environment changed? What plants occur where? Do they occur someplace differently now than they used to? Are they vanished or gone from an area?
He says it might even raise the possibility of using plant DNA to bring back extinct species.
It's more like a Jurassic Park dream. But DNA is DNA, who knows? Before 1952, we wouldn't have known what DNA was, right? And much less that you could get it out of museum specimens.
At Muhlenberg College, ecologist Rich Niesenbaum just finished adding its plant collection to the database. He's using it to track down a rare and possibly endangered plant called the flat-stemmed pondweed. But going by the centuries-old handwritten notes isn't easy.
It's a grass, an aquatic grass, growing in Cedar Creek south of Fairview Street.
The notes also mention a quarry, and there's only one in Allentown, so he's pretty confident he knows where to go. We head to Cedar Creek, where thickets of reeds and cattails line the banks.
There's a lot of poison ivy here.
I don't see any grass down in here.
Crowding out everything else are invasive species like Japanese knotweed and stilt grass. One reason why some of these native plants are endangered. But then he does spot the rare grass.
All right, I'm getting in the creek.
Oh, that's refreshing.
Yeah, I think we'll take this back to the lab and take a look at it.
So does it surprise you to even find it here?
Yeah, I'm surprised. I mean, that's exciting because as a plant hunter, right, we spend a lot more time hunting and looking than actually finding. If this is indeed the rare plant and it's here right in an urban environment, in an urban setting, that offers a lot of hope.
Niesenbaum says he'll grow it in the lab to make sure it's a match. If so, it will be added to the database, minus the exact location. Because the plant's at risk of being extinct, that will be kept a secret. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Other institutions are participating in this effort, including the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. There's more about that at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holzapfel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.